The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Hi, I'm Daniel Lucas.
And this is Matt, the Doctor of Music.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. One Sidaka's comeback, kind of momentum, and of course, breaking up and building anew, the enduring craft of Neil Sedaka.
Yes, indeed. So another of these talks away, Neil Sedaka's decade career represents one of pop music's most remarkable arcs. From brill building songwriter in the 1950s through commercial eclipse in the 1960s to triumphant reinvention in the 1970s, his story illuminates not just the mechanics of hit making, but the deeper architectures of popular song, how melodies endure, how careers resurrect, and how a great composition can be reborn in an entirely new form. This is a journey through the essential Sedaka catalog, guided by craft, context, and the startling alchemy that transforms three-minute pop songs into cultural touchstones.
Indeed. So let's start at the beginning, Mr. Mac. How did Neil Sedaka break into music business, and what is the real building system that shaped his early work?
Well, Neil Sedaka entered professional songwriting through the front door of American pop's most efficient hit factory, the Brill Building in New York City. By the late 1950s, he and his songwriting partner Howard Greenfield were working as writers for hire, crafting songs for established performers who needed material. Their breakthrough came with Stupid Cupid, 1958, written for Connie Francis, someone that we have taken a look at on this very program. Sedaka was initially uncertain about the song, worrying that Francis, a classy lady, would find it too silly. Instead, she literally jumped up and down with excitement when she heard it. And she was right to be excited. Stupid Cupid is irresistibly silly, featuring intentionally off-key guitar twangs and a perfect encapsulation of late 1950s pop innocence. But beneath the surface frivolity lies sophisticated craftsmanship. The melodic hook is mathematically precise, the lyrical conceit is clear and repeatable, and Francis's vocal performance sells the emotional stakes completely. This was Brill Building model in microcosm. Professional writers delivering tailor-made hits for specific performers, combining commercial instinct with genuine musical sophistication. Sedaka and Greenfield followed this success with Where the Boys Are, 1961, another Connie Francis vehicle that became her signature song. Remarkably, both Sedaka and Greenfield initially hated it. Greenfield thought the title was stupid, and they wrote it in a hurry to meet a film deadline. Yet the resulting ballad is classy and cinematic, filled with lush strings and a powerful sense of yearning that transcended its origins as a theme song for a teen comedy about premarital sex. The song became an entry point into understanding how professional songwriters could produce work of genuine emotional depth, even under commercial pressure and tight deadlines. The Brill Building system itself deserves deeper examination. Located at 1619 Broadway, the building housed dozens of music publishers, songwriters, and producers in proximity, creating an ecosystem of creative competition and collaboration. Writers like Sedaka and Greenfield worked in small cubicles, often hearing rival teams through thin walls, spurring each other to greater heights. This was Tin Pan Alley reimagined for the rock and roll era, professionalized hit-making that combined old-school craft with new generation energy. The system produced an astonishing percentage of 1950s and early 1960s hits, and Sedaka quickly established himself as one of the most reliable practitioners. In conclusion, Sadaka's brill-building apprenticeship established the dual nature of his genius, an ability to craft commercially viable pop confections while smuggling in melodic sophistication and emotional authenticity that would allow these songs to endure long after their cultural moment had passed.
Measure Mac, when did Sadaka transition from behind the scenes songwriter to performer in on its own right? What songs define the breakthrough?
Sadaka's breakthrough as a performer came with The Diary in 1958, a song inspired, ironically, when Connie Francis refused to let Sadaka and Greenfield read her diary for songwriting material. But his early defining hit was Oh Carol, 1959, a pay-on to his ex-girlfriend, Carol Klein. The song's irrepressible melody stands in fascinating tension with its lyrics of romantic misery. I am but a fool. Klein herself was impressed enough to write an answer song, O'Neill, which she recorded under her new professional name, Carol King. This exchange between future legends represents one of pop music's most charming footnotes. The personal nature of Oh Carol marked an important shift. While still working within the Burial Building's commercial framework, Sadaka was beginning to inject genuine autobiography into his material. This wasn't confessional singer-songwriter territory that would come later in the 1960s with Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, but it represented a middle ground where professional craft met personal expression. The result was songs that felt both universal and specific, generic enough for mass appeal, yet personal enough to carry emotional weight. One Way Ticket to the Blues, 1959, demonstrated that Sadaka's early work wasn't simply poppy fluff. Despite its exuberant rhythm and clever lyrical references to other rock and roll hits, the song carries an impressive minor key darkness, amplified by ghostly backing vocals. This darker undercurrent would become a Sadaka signature, the ability to embed genuine melancholy within up-tempo arrangements. On the other hand, Sadaka and Greenfield were more than capable of turning out fluffy teen pop novelties when required, as evidenced by Calendar Girl, a song that somehow makes an adolescent boy ogling a pinup sound curiously wholesome. Maybe if I ask your dad and mom, they'd let me take you to the junior prom. One suspects the song's backing vocals, counting down the month's structure, pricked to the interest of a young Brian Wilson. Listen to it next to the Beach Boys' 1965 single, When I Grow Up to Be a Man, and you can spot its influence. Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, 1961, continued this vein, positioning Sadaka as the voice of a clean-cut teenage romance. But there's an interesting subtext to these seemingly innocent songs. Happy Birthday, Sweet 16 is ostensibly about a boy watching his neighbor's girl grow up and finally becoming romantically available. In the context of early 1960s pop, such narratives were standard romantic fantasy material, reflecting the era's more circumscribed approach to adolescent sexuality and courtship. In conclusion, Sadaka's early performer hits established him as more than a brill-building functionary. He became a distinctive vocal presence capable of delivering both darkness and light, sophistication and innocence, often within the same 3-minute single.
So, Mr. Mink, let's talk about the breaking up is hard to do, both versions. What make this song so special in Sadaka's catalog?
Breaking Up is Hard to Do exists in two radically different versions, and together they form perhaps the most instructive case study in pop reinvention. The original 1962 version was Sadaka's first U.S. number one hit, a doo-wop-inspired up-tempo confection with an instantly memorable down-doobie-doo-down-down hook. Even in this commercial form, the song was melodically sophisticated, demonstrating that early 1960s pop was more musically complex than its later reputation suggested. But the real revelation came in 1975, when Sadaka returned to the song and recorded it as a piano ballad. He dispensed with the doo-wop hook line entirely, slowing the tempo and performing it as a faintly jazz-influenced torch song. This version made the song sound less like a relic of a lost pop era than an entry in the Great American Songbook. This was extraordinary, Sadaka proved that his original composition possessed sufficient melodic and harmonic depth to be completely recontextualized without losing its essential identity. This transformation invites a larger reflection. In the History of Religion, Mircea Eliade wrote extensively about the concept of eternal return, the idea that narratives and rituals are perpetually reactivated and made present again through reenactment. Sadaka's reworking of Breaking Up is Hard to Do functions similarly. He wasn't merely recycling or exploiting nostalgia, but rather reactualizing the song's core emotional truth for a new era and a more mature audience. The 1962 version, it captures the breathless drama of teenage heartbreak. The 1975 version reveals the deeper, more enduring ache beneath. Both are authentic expressions of the same fundamental human experience, separated by interpretation and context. The 1962 version is literal, heartbreak as an immediate crisis. The 1975 version is allegorical and anagogical. Heartbreak is a timeless human condition, viewed with the wisdom of experience. In conclusion, the two versions of Breaking Up is Hard to Do demonstrate that truly great songs possess an almost scriptural quality. They can be reinterpreted, reimagined, and made new without losing their essential power, revealing different facets of the same emotional diamond.
Mr. Meg, what happened to Sadaka's career in the 1960s after the Beatles arrived? How did he try to adapt?
The British invasion devastated Sadaka's commercial fortunes. His assessment was blunt. The Beatles' arrival in America was not good for his career. Overnight, his style of polished, sophisticated pop craftsmanship was rendered passé by the raw energy and self-contained songwriting of British beat groups. Sadaka struggled throughout the mid to late 1960s, releasing material that failed to connect with the rapidly changing youth market. There were occasional bright spots. His 1964 single, Sunny, has a Beach Boys redux quality worth revisiting. More significantly, We Had a Good Thing Going, 1967, recorded by the Brian Epstein-managed group The Circle, proves Sadaka could adapt to contemporary sounds. It is entirely delightful sunshine pop, decorated with a weird pitch-shifting brass woodwind effect that suggested someone had been listening to the trumpet solo on Penny Lane. Sadaka was listening, learning, and trying to evolve. Let's take a look at Patty Drew's Working on a Groovy Thing, 1968. Unfortunately, Sadaka's career had slumped to the degree that his own version of Working on a Groovy Thing was only released in Australia. He no longer had a U.S. record deal. But the song itself is great and had legs. The Fifth Dimension had a 1969 pop hit with a luscious version in a gently psychedelic, easy-listening style. But Patty Drew's earlier, less successful cover is the pick, blending supremely classy orchestration with soul grit. The song blended supreme orchestration with raw vocal power. Sadaka could still write hits, but he couldn't get them recorded under his own name. The 1960s wilderness years reveal something essential about pop music's ecosystem. Sadaka hadn't lost his talent or his craft. His songwriting remained as strong as ever, as evidenced by the success of Working on a Groovy Thing when recorded by others. What he'd lost was cultural relevance, that ineffable quality of being of the moment that the pop marketplace demands. The counterculture wanted authenticity, rawness, and self-contained artist bands who wrote, performed, and produced their own material. Sadaka, trained in the division of labor Brill Building, suddenly seemed like a relic of a discredited system. By 1971, Sadaka was watching his ex-girlfriend, Carole King, achieve massive success with Tapestry, successfully transitioning from Brill Building writer for hire to contemporary singer-songwriter. Sadaka attempted the same pivot with his album Emergence, which included the affecting I'm a Song, Sing Me, literally a plea from the commercial wilderness, and the spectacular Superbird 1971, with dramatic shifts in mood and tempo. The album is one of Sadaka's best albums and his personal favorite. American audiences ignored it completely. In conclusion, the 1960s taught Sadaka a harsh lesson about pop music's Darwinian marketplace. Talent and craftsmanship alone weren't sufficient when cultural winds shifted, but the quality of his work during this period would prove essential to his eventual resurrection.
Mr. Merrick, how did Sidaka's career revive in the 1970s, and what role did the recording studio in Northern England play in that comeback?
The story of Neil Sedaka's 1970s comeback is deeply unlikely and profoundly instructive. While touring British clubs in the early 1970s, Sedaka discovered Strawberry Studios in Stockport, recently established by four local musicians, Graham Goldman, Eric Stewart, Lal Cream, and Kevin Godley, who were producing songs for American markets. Sedaka arrived with an exceptionally strong set of songs, and the resulting sessions proved pivotal for all parties. The musicians were so inspired by the success of the collaboration that they struck out on their own under the name 10cc, becoming one of the most innovative art rock bands of the decade. Their 1975 masterpiece was I'm Not in Love. The centerpiece of those Stockport sessions was Solitaire, 1972, a disconsolate ballad that became an easy listening standard. But the easy listening label undersells the song's emotional sophistication. Karen Carpenter's 1975 version is definitive. Her typically poised yet heartbreaking vocal reveals the song's deeper melancholy. Sedaka returned to Stockport the following year for the LP The Tra-La Days Are Over, which produced the fabulously euphoric Love Will Keep Us Together, 1973. Love Will Keep Us Together featured a spiraling chorus and a piano hook. Sedaka freely admitted he'd borrowed from the Beach Boys' Do It Again. Captain and Tennille's 1975 cover became a masterpiece of guilty pleasure pop, complete with a spoken word nod to its composer in the fade, Sedaka's Back. The song improbably influenced Joy Division. Drummer Stephen Morris confirmed that Love Will Tear Us Apart was ironically titled in response to Sedaka's optimistic anthem. From bubblegum pop to post-punk, the cultural reach of a well-crafted hook knows no boundaries. The Stockport connection deserves additional scrutiny because it represents a fascinating geographical and cultural exchange. Sedaka, the quintessential New York songwriter, steeped in American pop traditions, traveled to working-class Northern England and found creative kinship with musicians who would become 10cc, a band known for its sophisticated production, literary lyrics, and genre-blending experimentation. This wasn't a case of an American star slumming in the provinces. It was genuine artistic symbiosis. The 10cc musicians brought contemporary production sensibilities and a willingness to experiment, while Sedaka brought decades of melodic craft and professional discipline. The combination yielded some of the finest work of the both parties' careers. In conclusion, the Stockport sessions represent one of pop's great second acts, proof that quality songwriting, given the right collaborators and production environment, can transcend commercial fashion and launch careers, both Sedaka's revival and 10cc's formation, that reshape the decade's musical landscape.
Mr. Mink, once Sedaka's comeback gained momentum, what were the biggest successes and what do they tell us about his evolved artistry?
Within mid-1970s, Sedaka had signed with Elton John's Rocket Records label and was turning out a succession of hits that demonstrated regained confidence and refined craftsmanship. Laughter in the Rain, 1974, was the crown jewel, a gently breezy masterclass in seemingly effortless melodicism. The song became a huge transatlantic hit, ranking as the eighth biggest selling single of 1975 in America. The Guardian rightly calls it an awesome example of songwriting craft. Every inch is packed with hooks, yet nothing feels forced or overwrought. Sedaka claimed Laughter in the Rain was inspired by a drop-dead chord he'd heard in Elton John Deploy on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. This influence became even more pronounced on Bad Blood, 1975, a surprisingly funky electric piano-driven track featuring Elton John himself on backing vocals. The song reached number one in the U.S., proving Sedaka could compete with and collaborate alongside the reigning pop royalty of the 1970s. But perhaps the most fascinating track from this period is The Immigrant, 1974, Sedaka's rare foray into political commentary. The song was inspired by John Lennon's contemporary immigration struggles. Lyricist Phil Cody considered his own parents' arrival from Sicily and Sadaka's grandparents' journeys from Russia and Poland, crafting lyrics that mourned a vanished American openness, a time when strangers were welcome here, they've closed the door. Sadaka responded with a suitably yearning, wistful melody. It's a reminder that beneath the pop craftsman was an artist capable of addressing larger social themes without sacrificing musical sophistication. The Immigrant also marks an important evolution in Sadaka's lyrical approach. While Howard Greenfield had been his primary collaborator for two decades, Phil Cody brought a more explicitly literary and socially conscious sensibility. The result was songs that maintain Sadaka's melodic strengths while expanding their thematic range. This wasn't protest music in the Bob Dylan or Phil Oakes tradition. Sadaka remained fundamentally a melodic craftsman, but it demonstrated that pop craftsmanship and social consciousness weren't mutually exclusive. The relationship with Elton John deserves its own consideration. John was at the absolute peak of his commercial and critical powers in the mid-1970s, yet he actively championed Sadaka's comeback, signing him to Rocket Records and appearing on Bad Blood. This wasn't cynical calculation. John genuinely admired Sadaka's songwriting and understood that the brill-building tradition and the singer-songwriter movement weren't opposites but complementary approaches to pop excellence. John himself bridged these worlds, combining confessional lyrics with ornate melodic construction. His support of Sadaka represented a kind of intergenerational passing of the torch, with the 1970s superstar acknowledging his debt to an earlier era's master craftsman. In conclusion, Sadaka's mid-1970s peak represented not simply a commercial comeback, but an artistic maturation. His melodies remained as infectious as ever, but now they carried the weight of experience, loss, reinvention, and a broader engagement with the world beyond teenage romance.
Mr. Mank, one Sadaka song. One Sadaka has an especially peculiar history spanning multiple decades and continents. Can you walk us through the journey of Amarillo?
Is This the Way to Amarillo, 1971, has one of the strangest trajectories in pop music history. It began life as a country and western influenced track, was recorded by Sheffield's Tony Christie in a style that most resembled the Mitchell European brand of pop known as Schlager, and became a number one hit in Germany. Already, we have three distinct cultural contexts: American Southwest imagery, British Northern working class grit, and German continental pop fused into a single composition. But the story doesn't end there. Sadaka himself reclaimed the song in the mid-1970s, recording a version with an arrangement audibly influenced by reggae, adding yet another layer of cross-cultural pollination. Then, in the 21st century, the Tony Christie version was reissued as a charity single with a video starring British comedian Peter Kay, becoming completely ubiquitous in Britain and reaching number one again in 2005, 34 years after its original release. Sadaka's bemused reaction on his 2012 live album, recorded at the Royal Albert Hall. He says, "I guess I have to play the song." His puzzlement was understandable and touching. Here is a composition that has lived multiple lives across four decades, three continents, and at least five distinct cultural contexts: American country, British working class pop, German Schlager, Jamaican reggae, and British charity single novelty. The song has been adapted, and recontextualized so many times that it has achieved a kind of folk song universality, transcending its origins to become genuinely transnational. The phenomenon of Amarillo raises interesting questions about authorship and cultural ownership. Who owns the song at this point? Sadaka and Greenfield wrote it, but Tony Christie made it famous, at least in Europe, and Peter Kay's 2005 video campaign created an entirely new set of associations for British audiences who experienced it as a participatory charity spectacle rather than a romantic ballad. The song has become a kind of cultural commons, its meaning continually renegotiated by each community that adopts it. In conclusion, Amarillo demonstrates how a well-constructed song can escape its creator's intentions entirely, migrating across borders and genres to find new audiences and new meanings, a pop music equivalent of what anthropologists call cultural diffusion, where an artifact's significance is continually renegotiated by the communities that adopt it.
Indeed interesting. Mr. Meg, beyond the major hits, what other Sedaka songs deserve attention, and what do they reveal about his range?
Next Door to an Angel, 1962, is on the essential list and represents Sedaka's ability to craft perfectly calibrated teen pop without descending into formula. The song's premise, the narrator realizes the girl next door is actually his romantic destiny, is pure adolescent wish fulfillment, but the execution elevates the material. The melody is intricate, the vocal arrangement sophisticated, and the overall production demonstrates why Sedaka's early 1960s hits have aged better than many of their contemporaries. Stairway to Heaven, 1960, not to be confused with Led Zeppelin's 1971 epic, is another deep catalog gem. The early pop ballad showcases Sedaka's classical training. He studied at Juilliard, and his piano work throughout his career reflects that foundation. The song's arrangement is lush and overly romantic, demonstrating that even in the rockabilly influence late 1950s, there remains space for more traditional pop balladry. These lesser-known tracks matter because they demonstrate consistency of craft. Many artists produce one or two undeniable classics surrounded by filler. Sedaka's catalog reveals a songwriter who approached every composition with the same level of melodic intelligence and structural integrity. This consistency stems directly from his Brill Building training, where professionalism meant delivering quality material on deadline, regardless of personal inspiration levels. In conclusion, Sedaka's deep catalog rewards exploration, revealing a songwriter whose commitment to craft remained constant, whether writing obvious hit material or more modest B-sides and album tracks.
Mr. Meg, as we look back at Sedaka's full career, what largest lessons emerge about pop songwriting, reinvention, and cultural longevity?
Neil Sedaka's career offers several profound lessons about the nature of popular music and artistic survival. First, craft matters, but craft alone is insufficient. Sedaka's Brill-building training gave him impeccable melodic instincts and professional discipline. But when cultural fashion shifted in the 1960s, those skills couldn't save him from commercial irrelevance. What ultimately rescued his career was a combination of perseverance, adaptability, and fortunate circumstance. Finding the right collaborators, the Future 10cc, in the right place, Strawberry Studios in Stockport, at the right moment, their early 1970s singer-songwriter boom. Second, great songs possess a resilience that transcends their original arrangements and cultural context. When Sedaka transformed Breaking Up Is Hard to Do from doo-wop novelty to jazz-inflected ballad, he revealed what literary critics call the generative quality of major texts, works rich enough to sustain multiple interpretations without exhausting their meaning. Similarly, Solitaire has been successfully covered by artists ranging from Karen Carpenter to Elvis Presley to Andy Williams, each finding different emotional shadings in the same melodic architecture. Third, Sedaka's career demonstrates the value of humility and openness to influence. He freely admitted borrowing the piano hook for Love Will Keep Us Together from the Beach Boys. He studied Elton John's chord progressions and incorporated them into his own work. He adapted to reggae rhythms, sunshine pop production, and disco-adjacent funk without abandoning his core melodic sensibility. This isn't creative poverty, it's creative intelligence, the recognition that great artists are great synthesizers. Fourth, there's something visionary about Sedaka's relationship to his own catalog. His willingness to revisit and reimagine his earlier work suggests an understanding that songs are not fixed objects, but living texts that can and should evolve. Sedaka treated his own compositions with similar reverence and flexibility, recognizing that Breaking Up is Hard to Do meant something different to teenagers in 1962 than it did to adults reflecting on lost love in 1975, and that both meanings were valid and worth honoring. Solitaire isn't really about playing cards alone. It's about existential isolation and the human hunger for connection. The immigrant isn't merely about immigration policy. It's about belonging, displacement, and the recurring tension between hospitality and sovereignty that marks human societies across millennia. These songs achieve a kind of universality, not despite their specificity, but because of it. They root abstract emotions in concrete images and narrative situations. Sadaka continued making albums well into 2010s, recording Christmas collections, children's albums, and even a set of songs in Yiddish, returning to his cultural roots. But his essential legacy was secured in those Stockport sessions and mid-1970s hits, proof that excellent songwriting can survive commercial eclipse, that reinvention is possible without betraying one's core identity, and that pop music, at its best, is not disposable entertainment, but durable art capable of speaking to successive generations. There's a lesson here about the relationship between commercial and artistic success. Sadaka never pretended to be anything other than a commercial songwriter. He worked within mainstream pop traditions, aimed for radio play and chart success, and made no apologies for crafting accessible, melodic material. Yet his best work transcended these commercial origins to achieve genuine artistic merit. This challenges the romantic myth that commercial art is inherently inferior to uncommercial art, suggesting instead that excellence can emerge within any framework when executed with sufficient craft and emotional honesty. Finally, Sadaka's longevity, he was still performing into his 80s, testifies to the physical and emotional durability required for a sustained career in popular music. The music industry is littered with casualties, artists who burned out, faded away, or never recovered from commercial setbacks. Sadaka survived and even thrived throughout multiple industry upheavals, technological revolutions, and generational shifts in taste. His persistence wasn't mere stubbornness. It reflected a genuine love of songcraft and performance that sustained him through wilderness years when less committed artists would have abandoned the field entirely. Neil Sedaka's six-decade journey from brill-building apprentice to 1970s comeback king to elder statesman demonstrates that pop music's greatest rewards go not to those who chase trends, but to those who master craft, remain open to influence, and understand that the best songs, like the best stories, the best myths, the best prayers, are never finished. In conclusion, the best artists prevail only by continually being reborn in new voices for fresh audiences seeking the same eternal truths about love, loss, and the bittersweet comedy of being human.
Indeed, Mr. Meg, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. Thank you, thank you. The musical journey of Musica is a testament to resilience, reinvention, and the timeless craftsmanship of a true pop songwriter. Emerging from a creative powerhouse of New York Brill Building in the late 1950s, Sadaka quickly established himself as a master of melody with unforgettable hits like Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. And, of course, Calendar Girl. So, Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
Appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, grow the business, connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD, listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast, and also pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon. Bernie Merrill, on track, you know, fan of music, support true fans.
Yes, people, let's support Mr. Mick, the Doctor Digital, and please do listen to our other podcasts, Love Letters, Sex 101, and Mental Health 101, and of course, Music 101. So, Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Until next time, here's Paul.
More to come, people. See you soon.